Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2010. Lecture 5, delivered on September 8, 2010. The title of this lecture is Review of Accounting.
Today, Review of Accounting. As I mentioned before the podcast started, I spend maybe about a half an hour in Chapter 4, which is the Review of Accounting. Let me not trivialize accounting. Indeed, let me show respect for accounting. Okay, now having done that, accounting actually, and I'm speaking here, I don't know if I mentioned it, but one of my actual specialties, aside from being a professional financial economist, is I'm also a teacher of English and old, middle, and early modern English language and literature and linguistics. Interestingly enough, accounting is at the beginning of written language. We find that in the very early times when agriculture was becoming something organized, the trading centers would be places where people could move domesticated animals and sometimes grains for sale in a commercial fashion. And at first, what would be done is that the owner of livestock or something like that would have it transported to a trading center, and the trusted person would carry a jar with different little shapes for different kinds of animals. And the number of each shape represented the number of animals of that kind that would be expected to arrive at the marketplace, the commerce center. And these little shapes, maybe for a sheep, would be a little wedge like this, and for something that was more like a cow, a block, and things like that. And they would put these in the jar, and then the jar would be sealed and then broken at the place where the commerce was to occur, the transactions. Over time, these urns began to give way to just a simple clay tablet that would, instead of having these little shapes in clay, hardened clay inside them, the clay tablet would simply mark the number of sheep by that shape, the number of cattle, and those different things. And there was the beginning of written language, and it was accounting, for God's sake. That was how language in a written form. This is, of course, if you know anything about old languages, that's cuneiform. The little wedges and things like that you might see in ancient texts that you read about in high schools or in gen ed courses here. But it gives a good idea of how central managing the numbers is to a civilization, not just to people, but to the civilization in its expressed form of commercial interactions. In the Renaissance, there was a monk whose name was Pacioli. And Pacioli developed the double entry accounting system. Now that tells you something about what kind of a life a monk has. Obviously he had no sex, so he had to do accounting. And I kid you not, it was developed. Now, Pacioli's double entry accounting system proved to be hugely important to the development of commerce in the Renaissance because it allowed for the representation of transactions and a consistency from one company to another so that the wealthy could look at financial statements with an assurance that there was the same, they understood the rules were the same from one company to the other. A company that was successful, well, we can look at its financials. Now this company that comes to us with wanting money, well, certainly its financials, I can rely on this double entry accounting system to create a consistency, and I can be assured that the numbers are going to be at least relatively compatible, and I can understand this financial statement. Now, that didn't have just to do with accounting and business. In the Renaissance period in Italy, the de' Medicis were intimately linked to the banking system that was developing. And in that banking system, the financing of companies and the development of commercial transactions. But the de' Medicis were also at the center of the art world of the High Renaissance, and families like the de' Medicis. And so the finance and the banking, the accounting and the art were all intertwined. So when you talk about high civilization, unfortunately, one of the untold parts of that high civilization is accounting. Now, whether or not that makes me personally want to blow my chow, it's the reality of it. Accounting is important. Now, I caution you, I'm going to spend a few minutes here talking about accounting. I assume that you know accounting, or at least it can be jogged in your memory enough that you can get through a homework / take-home quiz that I'll give you this weekend. So I'm just going to summarily outline the expectations I would have on you. Mostly, for the purposes of review of accounting, I need you to know terminology. And Kyle, God, turn that damn thing off. Or at least get good music. I was teaching this morning and one of those went off and it was country music. My God. Qualifies for fail. Okay. Here we go. Look, I caution you though. Accounting information, as I told you the first day, accounting information is historical information. It doesn't tell us the future. It might give us a little bit of a window on the future, but in and of itself, we use accounting data. I'm going to teach you ratio analysis, all those kinds of great things as this course proceeds. But at the same time, always be aware that that's historical data. Always be aware that those are direct costs. Opportunity costs are not included in there. So when I talk about analysis, and if you were to take me for the second course, this spring possibly or next year in finance or in investments, you would hear me make a lot of distinction between what is called technical analysis and fundamental analysis. Now, technical analysis looks only at the numbers of a company and of a market, and from that designs to forecast the future. Essentially, to determine the quality of an investment, to determine the character of a market in which buy, sell, and hold decisions must be made. Fundamental analysis digs underneath the financials and looks at the company's management, the macroeconomic environment, and at other factors that could very well impact on its future. Now, I take the position that you do fundamental analysis after you have done some technical analysis. Do the technicals. Sometimes you can see why something happened. And then you can ask, are you over this? Or are you going to do this again? But at the end of the day, the technical analysis does not take you to the goal line of finding out about the quality of an investment or the character of decision-making that must be made in the future. So I begin with that. Now, there are a couple of points that you're going to see from a finance person's point of view that are a little different from what you would have learned in your accounting class. And among those are, first of all, let me give you, well, I'm going to give you a little background on what I did as a consultant, but in a minute. Let me give you the financial statements. Okay, now there is the income statement. And then there is the balance sheet. And then there is another one, statement of cash flows, or sources and uses, and I'll call it statement of cash flows, SOCF. And I've left one out. What did I leave out? Does anyone know? Say it. Say it. I'm not even, my ears are, what is it?
Retained earnings.
Retained earnings, statement of retained earnings, good. Okay, is there anything else? Have I got it all? Unfortunately, I got it all, right? No, there's one more. The one that is ignored, and I hope to God it's ignored, as a consultant. It's the notes to the financial statements. The notes to the financial statement. Let me explain what I did. I was a business consultant. My job was to help companies go public or get them into compliance if they had become public. My specialty was reverse mergers, a dirty world. And I got involved in a heavy-duty version of that where I got working with a couple of young rainmakers and their people who needed someone who would do the financials and put together a story that could be sold to investors. And so I would put together these, and also for other companies I did on other things like reverse mergers, I would put together these financial statements. And I could make these things look like they met all the general accepted accounting principles and all that. And then I had them handed off to an accountant who would audit, claim he audited them. And then I would hand them off to a lawyer who claimed that he had reviewed them and get them to sign off. And then we would move these on to the NASD. We would move them to the SEC and then to the NASD for listing on the OT, over-the-counter service. But you see, the notes to the financial statement is where you tell stories that the numbers themselves can't explain. So it was in the notes to the financial statement that I would make disclosures that the owners of the corporation were gobbling up stock for themselves. I would make disclosures in the notes to the financial statements. In fact, that was where I would explain, this company is going to go belly up. You see, this company is not a going concern. The financial statements I prepared assume that this company is a going concern. That is not a reasonable assumption with respect to this company due to its youth and its financial instabilities. You see, I would make those statements in the notes to the financial statement. So, hoping that no one would ever read those, we would have investors read these financial statements in the pro forma income statement and balance sheet, looking at the future in a rosy, bright fashion. And as long as they didn't bother to notice in the notes to the financial statement that the whole thing was bad news, we were in business, okay? So always keep in mind, read the notes to the financial statements. Now, next thing, let's see how much was covered in your accounting classes. Where do I find the financial statements? All of that stuff that I had up there. Where do I find that? Where would be the best place, one-stop place to find the financial information for a public company? Where would it be? Say it. 10K. Where is that? In fact, that was what I actually did. Where I started as where I made my meat and potatoes money early on as a consultant was I was an Edgar filing agent. It's the SEC's Edgar system. It's been around for a long time, an electronic filing system where public companies send their financial information electronically in essentially like a version of HTML, a broad form called SGML, it was in the old days. Each part of each and every financial statement had its own tags. You put all the tags together, and then you sent them to the SEC, and they were posted in the Edgar filing system. and Edgar, E-D-G-A-R. Later in the course, we will be looking at Edgar and prowling through it to find financial information, not just with respect to these financial statements, but looking beyond that into that fundamental analysis, looking at the management discussion and analysis of operations, and also some other things that we can find there as well. But know this, what you said was 10K. That is very true, and I'm going to go through this in more detail in the next chapter. But the annual financial statements are filed on Form 10K. Quarterlies, which are not audited, are filed on 10Qs. That's why you will hear me from time to time say, we'll look at the Qs and Ks. Those are the central repository of the information about a company. Annually in the 10K, audited financial statements, and then quarterly as the year goes along until they accumulate the four quarters to construct a 10K. Always be aware that there could be amendments to the 10K later, 10KAs, you would see. There's another financial statement there's another filing with the SEC that I'll bring up right now. And then I'll get more detailed on this in another lecture, shortly in another lecture. But one that I want you to be aware of right now is the 8K. This is a form that is filed with respect to non-recurring events. It could be an 8K could have to do with just a press release. We are disclosing now that we issued a press release. Or it could be with respect to the death of a director. So-and-so died in a hotel, sleazy hotel room we didn't expect him to be in. Or it could be with respect to a change of CEOs or something like that. 8Ks are a fast way to see something that has just happened that might have financial impact on a corporation. Might. And so you always work on the assumption that if there is some non-recurring event, you should, as a public corporation, file an 8K with respect to that event. It became almost ridiculous, though, because a lot of these companies that I was consulting for were small scam operations doing pump and dump. And pump and dumps, one of the ways you try to pump and dump is by creating all kinds of press releases to stir up investor interest. So every time these little companies would put out a press release for some stupid-ass thing, I'd have to file an 8K. Did that bother me? No, because I charged $50 for each one, even though it took me about 5 minutes to prepare it and file it. I'm a capitalist, sue me. Okay, now let's get down to the basics here. And a lot of what I'm going to do here is just to give you a little bit of shaping of terminology, just to make sure you know what I mean when I say gross margin or gross profit, when I say net income and all of that kind of stuff, or operating income. These terms I will use throughout this semester to know what I'm talking about and also to make a broader point here. But you have the income statement. Now, the income statement comprises a revenue line, and I am being simple here. If there is any accountant in here who wants to correct me by saying that I didn't include something, that accounting student will be shot. Revenue. Now, of course, revenue, you might have returns and allowances and all that, but it's revenue. Somehow you get revenue. Now, if it's a manufacturing type of company, you will have a cost of goods sold, COGS, and from there you will have a gross profit line. That's the word that you will hear, term you will hear me use, is gross profit. If it's a service industry, you're probably not going to see a cost of goods sold. But if there are costs of goods sold, the cost of goods sold would include those costs that can be related in some way, shape, or form directly to revenue generated. The cost of the widget that went into the widget that produced the work it or whatever. You know what I mean. Okay. And then you will have your expenses. And in these expenses, remember that in accounting, they are recognizing expenses, whether or not they created a cash flow or not. The biggest of those issues would be depreciation. You don't write a check to depreciation. No cash flow actually occurs with depreciation whatsoever. But in the income statement, you will see depreciation. So that would give you an indication that as a financial analyst, we have to add depreciation expenses back in right away. That would be one of the first things that we would add back into the net income line is the depreciation, because depreciation is not money that actually flowed out of the corporation. What flowed out of the corporation was an expense on some item that was big that you're not allowed to expense all at once. So they carve it up by one depreciation system or another into chunks. But the money, the actual cash, all went out at once, and the depreciation is just parceling that cost out over time. So every time we see a depreciation, we have to add it back in. The original cost that came out of the pocket of the corporation to build a building, that was a cost we recognized right away as financial analysts. Okay, now the depreciation, salaries and administrative expenses, and other things like that, meals and entertainment, which I always favored to make as large as possible, and such things as that. And after you've gotten those out, you come down to the line that is called the earnings before interest and taxes, EBIT. That's operating income, operating. You'll hear me use that term, operating. That's operating, EBIT. And then you're going to net out the interest expense. Now, in this course, I will usually do something pretty simple. Assume that they've got $15 million in their average interest expense is 8%. And so you'll net out something like that as an interest expense, some dollar amount in an easy fashion. And then you will come down to the earnings before taxes line, EBT. Now, taxes, you share with me, were you taught how progressive tax structure works in your accounting class? I'm getting a little bit of a blank, and I've seen that. I know you're not bullshitting me. The students are not shown progressive tax structures. And I think I'll hold that off and maybe clean up a few things next time on that, because that's a whole story in itself, progressive tax structures. Essentially, in our tax system, we tax larger tiers, higher tiers of income at a rate that is higher than lower tiers of income. We do that at the personal level, and we do that at the business level as well. Interestingly enough, at the business level, well, I won't get into it too much, but to give you an idea, at the business level, if I'm not mistaken, there are 6 tiers right now of taxes. Now, the textbook that you're using, it will list the different marginal tiers. But like I said, I think I'm going to hold that off for another one. For now, for the tax purposes, I'm just going to say, look, tax is, let's say, 20% of income. For most problems that I would do, of EBT, count the tax as 20% of income before taxes. That's how I would normally do it in any kind of a problem in this class. I can get it a little more complicated than that, but it's really not necessary. But at the end of the day, after you've taken out your tax bill, you have net income. After you've taken out the taxes, you get your net income. Now, the net income has to be shaped against the reality of the cash flow. Remember that what that's in net income tells you is the accounting version. That net income took out expenses that don't exist in cash terms, like depreciation. It took out expenses like if it's monthly, it took out expenses for things like insurance premiums per month, when in reality you paid your whole year's insurance premium in one shot. It put in things that might not belong there as well. So this net income is a dangerous animal to take on its own. But once you've got the net income, from there, you're going to take out your dividends. And what is left after that would be the earnings of the corporation. Really, a financial analyst really isn't all that excited about earnings per se. What we're interested in is earnings per share, EPS, which means that we have to divide by the number of shares. Now notice that I'm writing number of shares two different ways here. In the first way, I look at the number of shares that are outstanding. But in the second way, I look at the number of shares that could exist. Because almost inevitably, there are going to be people, especially executives and people like that, who have options that they can exercise to create shares. So over here, the number of shares that could be outstanding. This second EPS is called the fully diluted EPS, the fully diluted EPS. I am actually more interested, just, and this is a personal thing for me, I am more interested in the fully diluted than I am in the EPS. It just gives me a better window on what's possibly going to happen when the CEO exercises his options, his warrants, or whatever the hell he has, or what's going to happen if suddenly there is some kind of a management shakeup and a bunch of guys are kicked out and they exercise all their options and dilute down the outstanding or dilute up the outstanding a mile. Now here's something that is a little different between an accountant and a financial analyst. The income statement in accounting is taught as a separate financial statement. But honestly, the income statement in a broader view is nothing but a giant nodule attached to the balance sheet. It really isn't a separate statement because everything in the income statement is driving down to the point where you get how much money is going to be added to retained earnings of the corporation. Everything in that income statement has the purpose of constructing a final number that says this is what we are going to add to the retained earnings at the beginning of the period to create the retained earnings at the end of the period. So when I see this, I'm really, first of all, seeing the statement of retained earnings is right there just smacking me around. But more importantly, that entire structure there is just like a sidebar calculation on the balance sheet. The balance sheet has on one side the assets. On the other side, it has the liabilities and the owner's equity. The liabilities and the owner's equity. Now, here's a, by the way, just as a note, and I swear this actually kind of shocked me. You go through all these undergrad grad program, and I started doing work on transnational companies, and I had this guy. He was a Swiss fellow, and he was talking about the internal and external liabilities. And I wasn't quite sure what he meant. And I finally, I tried to act like I knew what I was doing, but I finally said, what is the difference between internal and external liabilities? And he said, oh, internal liabilities, you call those, I think he said you call those assets. So in their terminology in Europe, they see essentially everything on the balance sheet in terms of liabilities. The liabilities that belong essentially on one side versus the liabilities that belong on the other side. I'm not sure. I guess I see the logic of it, but I just caution that if you go into international, you might hear that term internal and external liabilities. But anyway, on this side, current liabilities, current assets. And the current assets, of course, include your big one, cash, and marketable securities. And then you've got other ones, accounts receivable on here. You've got some other things here, prepaid expenses, inventory. Now, as you go down the grinder in this, you're getting into less and less liquid territory in terms of its ability to be converted into cold, hard cash. But at the end of the day, and I'm not going to go through an exhaustive list right now, I think I'll finish this subject on Monday, this whole subject, you get your total current assets. Now, adding to that, you're also going to get your long-term assets or your fixed assets. And in a course like this, it's not going to be a major detail on this. You would get some kind of gross fixed assets, less accumulated depreciation, and that would give you your net fixed assets. And like I said, in a course like this, that's all the detail I would probably talk about, is just at that level, even that. But then you add up the current and the long term and you get your total assets. Liabilities and owner's equity, first of all, on the liability side, you have your short-term liabilities. And that includes lots of different things, but the ones that we'll be watching for in this class would mostly have to do with notes payable, short-term instruments payable, and accounts payable, notes payable, that kind of stuff. Be cautious, put this in your notes, that later in the course we're going to do ratio analysis. As a matter of fact, next week we'll start doing ratio analysis. When I say debt, don't look at just the long-term debt. That's where the big 800-pound gorilla of debt's going to sit that you see on a financial statement. Make sure you catch any notes payable up here. Catch anything that shows up here at the notes payable line. And I'll tell you why that is. I actually was sort of blasé about worrying about notes payable myself. And then it was just last year or the year before that, I like to do real financial statements, which is what we'll do next week. I pulled a public corporation looking at its financial statements. And it occurred to me after I'd already done some ratios and talked about it and used just long-term debt, I suddenly realized that this company, over the past 5 years, had been moving from long-term debt to short-term debt. In other words, by ignoring the notes payable as part of the total debt structure, it looked as if this company was like becoming less debt laden. But in fact, what it was doing, it was leveraging in on its debt. And that, as it turned out, was part of a working capital management shift. That goes to fundamental analysis. Because once I began to realize, okay, this company is actually moving from long-term debt to short-term debt, now the question is, why? And then as I looked into it, there were a couple of new members in the executive ranks, and it occurred to me, these are cats I've seen before. They actually move towards short-term debt wherever they go. So it was actually part of the, you see, what I'm trying to point out here is that sometimes fundamental analysis begins with just a technical analysis and just catching something. So when I say use debt in the denominator or something like that of a ratio, make sure you include any notes payable that are up there in the short term. Because right now, this will be your total short-term liabilities. Accounts payable, notes payable, and some other stuff like that. And then you'll have your long-term liabilities. Now, what will happen in the long-term liabilities, you'll have a lot of different animals in a real-world situation. The one we focus on is long-term debt. But you can see other things in there. Long-term liabilities, including exposures that have to be disclosed in the financial statements. You might see those there. But one way or the other, you'll get other things besides long-term debt, but that's the one we focus on in this class. So at the end of the day, I have my total long-term liabilities added to my short-term liabilities, and then that gives me my total liabilities. Now, for the purposes of this class, we then would go over and look at the owner's equity section. Okay, and we would have common stock at par, additional paid in capital, now, common stock at par. Historically, stock was issued with a tiny bit of value, actually intrinsic to each share. And so if I sold, let's say I sold 1,000 shares of ABC Common, par value, let's say, 10 cents per share, and I sold that for, let's say, $50,000. That would have meant that I sold each of the shares for $50. But the way you would represent it in the accounting statement would be that there would actually be $100 of that $50,000 would be represented as a common stock at par, and then the $49,900 residual would be the additional paid in capital. It's a historical phenomenon. There are a lot of companies these days that are issuing stock that has no par value. But don't be weirded by that double setup there. It's just a sort of like a technical breakup of how much they sold the stock for. Now, retained earnings, beginning of the period. To that retained earnings would be tagged on the net income for the period minus the dividends paid out at the end of the period to create the retained earnings, to create the addition to retained earnings, so that at the end you would say retained earnings end of period, which would then add to these common stock at par, additional paid in capital to create the owner's equity of the corporation. Total equity. And then these two added together would equal that, the total assets. And that is as far as and as deep as I would want to go. And I think, like I said, I will finish this lecture on Monday. I will clean up and we'll do one together on this. But that gives you the basic outline of what I'm expecting you to know.